now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game. I'm Gab Marcotti and I'm here with a reaction to an eventful New Year's program. To help me do that and to welcome in 2013, I'm joined by Tony Evans, Stuart Robson, and with his crystal clear Skype line, by popular request, it's Ollie Kay. In today's show, we'll be having a look at the FA Cup, which kicks off for the big boys this weekend. But we start at Stamford Bridge. All right, Ollie, I'm going to start with you because you were there, as was I. I want to get one thing out of the way very, very clearly. Rio Ferdinand, which I'm a huge fan of as a person, tweeted this morning, aha, further evidence that the Premier League is the most interesting, exciting in the world because QPR beat Chelsea. Now, I personally feel that that's not what makes the Premier League the most exciting league in the world, because it actually happens in other countries too all the time. And I'd argue that QPR, part of the reason QPR beat Chelsea is the randomness that occurs when you get professional athletes and you don't give them time to train and you make them play too many games in a short period of time. Are you with me or are you with Rio?
I'm with you, actually.
I don't think that's necessarily
the greatest illustration of the Premier League's unpredictability. I think, you know, QPR have been dire this season. You look at their players, they are capable of getting results. You look at Chelsea's players, and although they're European champions, you know, they are a team in transition. They're vulnerable on occasions, and Chelsea have been flagging. I think QPR couldn't get any worse. It was a more level playing field than it perhaps might have been expected.
Tony, we wrote a piece in The Times where Rafa talked about this before the game, how well his rotation system works and how necessary it was and how, thanks to the system, everybody's well-rested and fresh and whatever. And then he plays Marco Marin, Oscar and Moses behind Fernando Torres, and Chelsea can't get anything going. Is this God being mean to Rafa once again, or is it actually that Rafa's right? You got to rotate, but you play these guys and they're not good. Marin's not good.
I've never been the greatest fan of rotation. It's one of those areas that I differ with Rafa on. You know, I understand Chelsea have played a lot and he's, you know, the struggling a little bit. But at this stage, if you take away the trip to Japan, everyone's played a lot. You know, I would have put the best team I could out, and then I'm worried about things further down the line. Having said that, you know, we always deride Harry Redknapp for not being a tactical manager, but he's coming. He's got his tactics spot on, hasn't he? He's played very deep. No strikers. You know, he's parked the bus there and nicked one. So I mean, you know, it happens. As for the most exciting league in the world, oh come on, Rio! And anyone who thinks this is a wonderful league is delusional.
I think it is a wonderful league, Tony. Are you calling me deluded?
Yeah. Because, you know, defending is a forgotten art.
You just praised Harry Redknapp for defending and for parking the bus and defending with, you know, by the way, for those who didn't see, right? So he plays a back four, right? He's got Nelson and Clint Hill at the back. He's got the two fullbacks. He's got, you know, Stefan Bia, who's the size of a large refrigerator, and Sean Derry, who doesn't really move but kind of occupies space. With Granero, Mackey and Sean Wright Phillips, who came on for Hoylett early on, are basically adjunct fullbacks. The one attacking impetus comes from Adel Taarabt, who's wonderfully skilled, and you know he's too good for you, as a QPR fan saying. but the guy doesn't actually run
let's just stop there. Withdrawing everyone deep and playing everyone deep is not the art of defending. It's flooding areas. I mean, it's not defending with any particular intelligence. It's playing the percentages. I'm talking about defending being a lost art. People who know how, fullbacks who know how to use the line, centre-halves who know how to use space, and I'm talking about defending as a platform to attack and being secure at the back. Now, we've got this haphazard league where everyone's scoring tons of goals or everyone's parking the bus when there's no real defending, no skills of intending, no intelligent defending, well, very little going on.
You are absolutely spot on, Tony. It's refreshing to hear that somebody speaks the same sort of language that I do about defending. The game in the Premier League, they've lost the art to defend. Mm. And you're quite right. All that QPR did, yes, that they got numbers behind the ball, they flooded. Chelsea did it last year and they won the European. Mm. It wasn't great defending. They got numbers and eventually people couldn't quite get through them. And when you're tired, it's harder to break teams down because you've got to supply the impetus. And that's what happened with Chelsea last night. I can't say that QPR played fantastically well. They got numbers behind the ball. They scored a goal on the counter-attack late on in the game. And they just defended with resilience. They didn't defend with intelligence, I don't think.
It's the art of riding your luck. You know, if you look at QPR, or even if you look at Chelsea winning the Champions League, what they did, they got bodies back. They didn't snuff out the chances. Against Barcelona, the chances were still there. The great defenders stopped the chances.
Liverpool in the 70s and 80s, when they were the best team in world football, not only would they pass you off the field, you couldn't get a kick against them. You know, as a midfield player going to Anfield, if you got... 6 or 7 touches on the ball, you were lucky, because they knew how to defend. They knew how to press the ball. They knew how to defend balls being played in behind. They when they had the ball, they played really well. That's top class play. Mourinho at Chelsea, when Chelsea were the top side, not only were they good on the ball, they didn't allow you to play. They didn't just sit back and defend deeply. They understood how to defend. Barcelona, in their own way, if you can play beyond their initial pressure, you can get at them. But they have a defensive strategy and they do it really well all over the field, and particularly in the front areas.
Ollie, there's so much nodding in agreement in the studio. Do you want to provide some dissent here and maybe stick up a little bit for Harry?
Well, I would say that I would agree with Stuart and Tony about the quality of defending in the Premier League, which written a few times this season has been dire. I mean, particularly you look at the way they defended in the Champions League. It's been shown really how poor the defending is. I think the most important thing in many ways from where they were on Sunday. He must have been furious with them at half time on Sunday when they were 3-0 down to Liverpool. Redknapp's handling of the team after Sunday, I mean, he had the choice of savaging them in his post-match press conference, opted not to, went to try to encourage them and coax them into the belief that they could still stay up. And I think it's about cajoling players and giving them belief that they still amount to something sometimes. It's I think that sort of softer approach and cajoling, encouraging approach probably worked well for them and was probably a big factor in them making sure that they perform for the first time in weeks.
With Fernando Torres, the impression certainly has been that he has to play every game and it's not really down to the manager. Also, now he really has no other strikers there with Sturridge gone. Demba Ba is coming in. I got the impression that Torres was even worse than usual because now, on top of everything else, he's also physically knackered because he has to play every single game and they play a lot of games. Do you think Rafa's going to deal with that?
Well, obviously, Demba Ba will give him options. I mean, Torres looks like a player who needs a rest. I mean, he's also apparently been spending a lot of time on the weights because to build up his upper body, the general feeling was he's getting knocked off the ball too easy. He looks like he'll need a little rest. We've got the FA Cup coming up. You know, he'll probably sit him down for that. Who knows whether he'll play him against Swansea next week in the League Cup.
What if he sits him, Demba Ba, assuming he comes, and I understand it's not quite done as we're taping this, but what if he sits him and Demba Ba, whoever plays up front, does very well? And then
I'm sure he'll go
Fernando gets unhappy.
I'm sure he'll go to two up top and see how that works out. Maybe drop off Demba Ba a bit deeper and have Torres running past him.
Would he really go just to keep Torres in the lineup? He'd really go and play two up top and, you know, forget Hazard, Mata, all these other guys, Oscar, who are good and who can play. Is your reading really that there's so much pressure on the manager to play this guy at all costs?
Well, I think the suspicion is that the owner likes them to play Torres. But the bottom line is, I think Rafa will do whatever he needs to do to win, and I think he thinks he can get goals out of Torres.
At what point do you think Rafa's opinion might change? And at what point where Stuart, do you think he gets to the conclusion that, all right, you know, I'm kind of damned if I do, damned if I don't. If I play this guy, you know, there are going to be situations where it is like playing like 10 men. And if I don't play him, then maybe the owner will get upset. But maybe the owner will wake up one day and be like, hey, you know, there's no team in the world that has one center forward who plays him all the time, every minute of every game. And on top of that, he isn't good.
No, he's going to have to rotate him at some point because the centre forward will get tired, and particularly if you're playing up front by yourself. But when I look at Torres, he's not the same player he was 3 years. Not because of any formation, not because of players playing in the wrong positions behind him or not feeding in the right ball. He's not the same player. When I saw him play for Liverpool, when he balls were played over the top, he looked as though he could outrun people. I don't think he can outrun people now. When he picked the ball up in the inside left position, he'd run at the defender, check one way, check the other, and get a shot in at goal. He doesn't ever look as though he's going to do that anymore. That's down to him as an individual. He's lost confidence, he's lost speed, he's lost the ability to go past players.
Again, that's why they're looking at trying to get his strength up, because they think his pace isn't as where it was, and he gets knocked off the ball if you catch him. So, you know, they're trying to get him, you know, so he can withstand those challenges.
Ollie, is this the single most bizarre thing in football, the fact that you've got the champions of Europe who go into the season with just two people who can play up front, and they just don't address this? I mean, is your sense really that people deal with this as normal, that people at Chelsea Football Club or football people, you know, don't see this? It just seems so blindingly obvious to me. I don't think in the history of the universe there is another team that has done this.
There was a view last season that Torres was slightly cowed by the presence of Drogba, and that he needed to be the sort of undisputed first choice centre forward if he was to thrive. And I think the sort of rationale behind that has been exposed as being extremely flimsy. I mean, I think he's been awful the last two games, to be quite honest. Sky flashed up a statistic pre-match yesterday where they said that he had 30 goal attempts in 20 games. 30 goal, or it was 33 or something like that. But when you're playing in that team as the one striker, starting every week with those creative players behind you, I think he's shown in the first half of this season, although he's still scored a few, I think he's finished as a top level player. And I think Demba Ba will come in and he'll score more goals than Torres does. Torres will be back to square one.
All right. Frank Lampard, just to wrap this, Ollie, what's your information? Did I see you get into a Twitter conversation with somebody where you suggested that they haven't reached out to Frank at all?
Yep, that's right. My understanding, and it's based on very solid information, is that there has not been an offer. There have not been negotiations at all with Lampard, and the club are happy to let him go. And I think that's ridiculous, because I know he's, I know he's 34. I know he's on big money, but what would Manchester United do in the same situation? What did Man United do with Scholes and Neville and Giggs and all these people? What United do is that they realise the value of someone like that, and people sort of characterise Lampard as being some huge ego and player power and all this kind of thing. And Lampard had any relationship whatsoever with Abramovich or with the people who run the club, he would get a long-term contract in the same way that Hilario and
so Lampard and Terry, and Lampard and Terry have no real influence.
Lampard
over
is
the club.
He's a victim of what he's going to be a victim of. What is clearly a very firm decision to reduce the wage bill at any cost. And I think, you know, Matthew Syed wrote strongly argued the case for that earlier in the week, but he was characterising it as a sort of hard-nosed business decision, head ruling heart. And I don't think I don't think Chelsea are using their head in this case. I think it's ludicrous to let him go. I think he's still one of their best players, certainly one of the most reliable players.
So just to be clear on this, for those who might have missed the point, they haven't even asked him if he wants to take a pay cut, which would kind of suggest that this is a hard-nosed business decision. That isn't true, because it's not as if he wants to keep the same money he's on. They haven't even discussed the negotiations at all. But Stuart, I want to ask you, because I think you wanted to jump in there. One of the feedbacks I've been getting in general about Lampard is that anybody who's spent some time with him, and I've been fortunate enough to do that, knows that he's not just more intelligent than 99% of footballers, he's more intelligent than 99.9% of people. I mean, I think this is just kind of an obvious fact. And I think in football, that makes many people uncomfortable. To have somebody who's intelligent and occasionally
questioning,
outspoken and questioning, and you can probably see where I'm going with this, Stuart. Yeah. But and I got this from the England coaches a while back, mm-hmm. who weren't quite sure. I mean, as one person who's worked with Lampard put it, he says, "Stupid people are very comfortable with Frank, and in football, there's many people who are not very intelligent, not very questioning. Mm-hmm. Just people who are slightly above average intelligence, like me." We kind of, and this is not me saying this, it's this person who's who I'm quoting, says, like, we're not sure about him because we can tell that he's very bright and possibly a bit potentially manipulative, and he could use his intelligence for good or for evil. And so you kind of want to move him away. And I mean, is that kind of the way the football fraternity, when you get somebody like that?
Yeah, it certainly can be, because a lot of managers aren't particularly intelligent, and if somebody's questioning of them and can cause them a problem, that's when they're quite often got rid of. Lampard, I think, is a better influence on Chelsea than John Terry is, although the Chelsea fans always think that John Terry's the kingpin. But I'd wonder how many managers Lampard and Terry have had an influence in getting rid of. You know, and if the board has been ruthless, or Abramovich has been ruthless with managers, there's no reason why he can't be ruthless with players. And if they feel as though it's now time for Frank Lampard to go, it's time for Frank Lampard to go.
Well, I think the manager of Chelsea at the moment thinks there is value in keeping Frank Lampard. He thinks he's a very intelligent player, and the cleverness that Lampard might scare some people certainly doesn't scare Benitez.
That would be the interim manager at Chelsea, which is probably why his weight in whether Lampard stays or goes, his influence isn't as great as it could be.
You see, whether he's the interim manager or the manager depends on whether they've won or they've lost. When they win 8-0, he's just the manager. When they get beat, he's the interim manager.
But you do agree that if he had a 3-year deal right now, he might be able to persuade the owner to keep Lampard around.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're off to the St. Mary's now, Southampton and Arsenal. This one finished 1-1. And now, Stuart, my impression was that Southampton deserved all 3 points, and that Arsenal, after maybe first 5-10 minute spell, just kind of went all flat.
You got it absolutely right. For 10 minutes, Southampton couldn't get the ball. They defended too deeply, and suddenly they got a couple of tackles in high up the field. The crowd got behind them, and I thought Adkins' game plan was absolutely superb, and Arsenal didn't know how to cope with it. They didn't play particularly well, and that's what you get with Arsenal. You get two decent performances, then you get a bad one. And if you play football off the cuff, if you don't have a strategy, both defensively and with the ball, you're always going to end up with performances like Arsenal had there.
Tony, why didn't he rotate? I mean, he played the same group that had beaten a very tired and leggy Newcastle team. Were you a bit surprised by that?
Well, not really. I mean, he hasn't got the greatest amount of choice there, has he? I mean, you look at that squad, and who are you going to be rotating too many of them in and out?
Coughlin, a bit of Ramsey, he's got some defenders.
Yeah, well, Ramsey hasn't been playing well at all, has he, for quite a while? I mean, since, he hasn't played well this year. He looks as if he's struggling for whatever reason. I don't think there was a lot of rotation there. The thing is, again, I think the result against Newcastle was deceptive. I mean, it was fairly close until, at 3-3, 15 minutes ago. And then all of a sudden, Newcastle lose the ball when they're attacking, don't track back because they're tired. And then, and all of a sudden the game's out of reach. It turns into a rout. And again, the mythology, this is why the Premier League's great. Actually, I just thought it showed all the flaws in it. But, the thing is, Arsenal are not that good a side. And they can't afford, really, Well, they can't afford to go into games without a plan. I think Stuart said it perfectly, and they do. They look all over the place. They look as if there's no. There is a philosophy there, and the philosophy is good football, but you know, there's nothing underpinning it. They don't look as if there's any system there. They don't look as if they've come out with a thought process of how they're going to beat teams like Southampton.
And that's been the case for several years now, because it's okay when things are going well and your players are playing well and you play around pressure and there's loads of pace in the side and you're scoring goals and you're winning games and you're playing high up the field. But when things start to go wrong, that's when you need to say, or you're not playing at your best, or you're tired, whatever it is that Arsene Wenger uses as excuses at times, you have to have a basic game plan. This is how we're going to defend. This is how we're going to win the ball back. This is where our starting point is on the field. This is what we're going to do. You look at the players, they're looking around at each other. Oh, you know, it's not quite going our way. The passes were going astray. There's nobody then being able to say, right, come on, let's get back to basics. It just doesn't work because they haven't got a game plan.
There's no outlet ball when they're under pressure. There's no, you know, there's no plan there where, you know, they can knock the ball, someone can hold it, and then they can push up. It's all haphazard. And
Ollie, these two are being so negative about Arsenal. Do you want to balance out the debate by saying some nice things, or do you join their them in their nattering negativity?
Well, they'd won four on the run till the other day, hadn't they? I mean, I agree that you know, that papered over the cracks somewhat, but it's I think people have got to be realistic about Arsenal. They have not got anything like as good a group of players as they did two or three years ago, which in turn weren't anything like as good as a group of players they had sort of three or four years prior to that. And I think people have got to be realistic about Arsenal's changed circumstances, their diminished circumstances. And
I would have thought, if you look at the players they've lost and you look at the players who come in, that's all the reason, all the more reason for hysteria. They've lost quality players, they've got a pile of poo in.
Well, I know it's a reason for why they're in this situation. I mean, everybody accepts that, but I think the idea that Wenger has lost the plot because his players aren't as good as they were, you know, this group of players isn't as good as the group of players from 3 years ago or 6 years ago, or whatever.
I'm going to have to pull you up on this, because, you know, you're saying all these things, and it's not just about the players. It's about there's no coaching going on at the football club. They aren't developing the players that they want. Some of the players that Arsene Wenger's bought, they've come to the club as good players. I've seen them play around the world and they've been decent players. And now they're worse than they were before they came to the football club. The reason being, there's no game plan. And if your players aren't quite as good, then you have to be a better coach. And you have to see what the problems are. And if the problems keep happening time and time and time again, as they've happened over the last 5 years, it means that the...
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Coaching isn't good enough, or the manager can't see the problems. And in my view, the manager can't see the problems because he doesn't address them and he doesn't see them. That's the problem. He doesn't see them.
Hey, sorry, can I ask you, if I just jump in there now. Steve Bould, right? We've been talking about he's like some kind of genius. He sorted out the defense and this and that. Is he not a balancing influence on...
But this has been the major problem. I don't know whether any of you were at the press conference where after three or four games, somebody said in the press conference, Arsenal are defending much better. Steve Bould's done a fantastic job. And Arsene Wenger went almost ballistic that it had nothing to do with Steve Bould. He was still in charge. Nothing had changed. And then two games later, when they concede goals against Chelsea, he almost suggested, well, Steve Bould, well, you know, what are you going to say about him now?
It's Steve Bould's fault.
Well, Steve Bould isn't having any influence on the team. He's not allowed to because Arsene Wenger takes the training. He had a great ally in Pat Rice who just put the cones out, took the warm-ups, and that's all he did. Steve Bould is now doing similar sort of things. And that's, I think, a real crime because Steve Bould is a decent coach.
The number of people who've come out, there's two things in particular which just really get my goat. And it's from certain people who come out and say, well, they should have signed Theo up 2 years ago. It's a no-brainer. You always signed somebody up 2 years ago. And Manchester United would have never let a player get to this stage. And the second one is completely demented and idiotic because I remember a fairly well-known Manchester United player, in fact, United's captain, who allowed his contract to run all the way down, if you recall, at Manchester United. And that was Roy Keane. And I remember Rio Ferdinand also letting his contract run, maybe not all the way down, but certainly let it run quite a ways down. So that's completely demented and idiotic. In my view, Arsenal have actually handled Theo Walcott's situation correctly thus far. They've played the percentages. They've said, look, he's worth this much to us. They see his development every day in training. And they're in a position to say, all right, he could become a superstar. He could be a squad player on a Champions League caliber team. We think it's this much. And I also think Arsenal were stung by when they did just what all these people are suggesting in extending somebody's deal when they had 2 years left, when they gave Nicholas Bendtner that gigantic deal, and now the guy's like a big Danish millstone around their neck. Am I wrong here, Ollie? Help me.
I think you're wrong. I think what Arsenal's responsibility was to do was to protect their asset. I'm sure it will cost them more money to do it now than it would have done had they sorted out a year ago. You do use the example of Roy Keane, but that was 1999. And they knew that he wanted to stay because he was, you know, because they were the best team in Europe at the time. They were European champions. It wasn't quite the situation where you've already had an exodus of players from Arsenal, partly because of the wage structure, partly because of the lack of success. And I think the two things are related. And they are in danger of losing yet another key player. I don't think he's a brilliant player. I don't think ordinarily he would be worth a club shattering their wage structure for. But I think you look at Arsenal, he is one of their more effective players. He is a very effective Premier League player. Yes, he's got gaps in his game, but I think he's worth them bending their wage structure to try and keep him. It's something they shouldn't have allowed to arise.
Tony, he's also somebody who's come out and said that he wants to play as a centre forward. Now, if I'm a manager, you know, that kind of sets off alarm bells for me. I mean, I kind of think like, sorry, who the hell are you to come and tell me this? And it seems to me Arsenal have been predicated, rightly or wrongly, on having a certain type of centre forward, which is why they signed Olivier Giroud, who's big and strong, and Theo Walcott's not big and strong. He's a totally different type of player. Should that come into the equation when considering whether to extend his deal or not?
If I'm the manager, I call him into my office and I flush his head down the toilet. he plays where I want to play. Here's the problem. If they do a deal for Walcott, it's one player too late, isn't it? Walcott is not the person that you change everything for. You make your stand there for. The stand should have come a long time ago, and they should have done it to players who have a higher quality. And you know, they got themselves into a situation where Van Persie was never going to stay in a million years, but you know, perhaps the deal should have been done for him earlier. And it's kind of like you do the deal for Walcott, the horse has bolted, hasn't it?
Well, you're absolutely right, Tony. Again, I keep agreeing with you. In the 80s, they had to sell Liam Brady. they had to sell Frank Stapleton. Their two best players went away, one to Manchester United, one to Juventus. So then they panicked into giving David O'Leary, who was another player that people were talking about, a massive contract, which he was way beyond what he was worth. And it's going to happen to Theo Walcott now. Theo Walcott wasn't playing in the team at the start of the season. He couldn't get in the side. Oxlade-Chamberlain was
Well, it was because they were also... It was a contractual thing.
If you look at Theo Walcott's appearance records over the years, he has not. He's only started around about 50% of the games. And until he scored the two goals against Tottenham, I would have thought he was out of the club almost. The fans were crucifying him. He had a terrible first half against Tottenham.
2011-12 was the first season that
He's finishing his much better than it ever was. He's now composed, and you've got to give him credit. And he is a threat with his pace. But as an all-round footballer, in terms of intelligence, technical ability, and game understanding, he's way down in the Arsenal pecking order.
Personally, I would let him go at this stage. Sell him to your mate Brendan Rodgers at Liverpool, who could use another winger.
And how are they going to pay the wages?
What?
How are they going to pay the wages?
He's a Liverpool fan. He'll take a pay cut to go to Liverpool, right? He said it a million times.
Whip rounds on the cup.
What? But it's okay. When you sell Andy Carroll to West Ham, you can divert his wages to pay for Theo. A word on and that way you've got Alec Oxlade-Chamberlain, who I think is pretty good, and you know, back him, give him playing time. I want to get a word on Southampton, because there's all this negativity surrounding Atkins and the club a couple weeks ago, and I thought in that game, certainly, you know, without Lallana, who from what I've seen is easily their best player and probably their second most gifted player as well. He's working it out, and he's working it out, you know, without maybe some of the big signings like Jay Rodriguez and Gaston Ramirez making a huge impact. But it seems to me like he's making it out actually the old-fashioned way, by actually coaching and getting players to play better.
Well, he had a great game plan against Arsenal. He realised, and if anybody's seen Kieran Gibbs, yeah, he's all right going forward. He's got a bad left foot. But the one thing he doesn't like is balls being played in behind him. So they played Jason Puncheon. He's not a good 1v1 defender. High and wide down the right-hand side. So he was the out ball all the time. They realised they could get space if they had good movement between the front two. They pressurised the balls in the right places. They forced it to go into Bakary Sagna, who didn't have a forward pass because they blocked that one off. And they knew that he'd have to try and play into midfield, but they got tight in there. They did brilliantly. And you could tell they had a game plan, unlike Arsenal.
I mean, the main problem they've got is they need defenders, and you know, the goalkeeper's a liability as well. I mean, I think they'll spend a little bit of money in the transfer window, and I think they'll stay up.
Ollie, you get the final word. Are they staying up?
I would say, yeah, I think it'll go down to the last day or thereabouts. Now, I would say that if they add to their squad, if they get somebody in who can perhaps shore things up a little bit at the back, whether it's defender, midfielder, goalkeeper, whatever, I think they can snap.
It's the third round of the FA Cup this weekend, and it seems like every January we talk about this and the excitement. And I actually have a friend who says that the draw for the third round is often more exciting than the third round itself, and I sometimes tend to agree. But Tony, what are you excited about?
Well, this is what's wrong with football, that people are not excited about third round weekends. You know, the fact that's thrown together minnows and giants, and everything's possible. And we'd rather watch the Premier League. We'd rather see a team win 7-3, one team against them. No, it's the greatest, the best weekend ever in the history of mankind.
Stuart?
Once again, I'm going to have to agree with Tony, because, you know, I always, I'm biased because I work on the FA Cup, but, you know, I love the FA Cup. I think it's a great competition. I love the third round. I love all the way to the final. And I just think that the fact that a minnow can beat a top side, the fact that managers are under pressure for the top sides if they lose against the lower leagues. For all that people say it doesn't matter, managers have to win against lower league opposition.
Would you like to be Brendan Rodgers going to Mansfield on
Absolutely
Sunday?
Absolutely not. Because if they lose that, he'd be under more pressure than any of the Premier League games he's lost.
As if Brendan Rodgers is going to get sacked this year. Does anybody really believe that?
No, he's not going to get sacked.
Okay, so what does he care? So I lose to Mansfield.
Okay, I'll give you another one.
Go ahead and say, my possession stats, we had 80%, blah, blah, blah. He'll be judged where he finishes in the league.
I'll give you another example.
Brendan Rodgers
cares. He won't be judged by where he finishes in the league.
What will he be judged on? Forward progress.
I think
possession stats, shots on goal.
I think he'll be judged on being Fenway Sports Group's appointment. That's all.
Okay, well, fair enough. But it's not.
But you know, when you're a manager, you know, even if you know you're not going to get sacked, it's like life is uncomfortable when the fans are criticising you, when the press are criticising you, when, you know, getting beat by Mansfield, there'd be misery around Anfield. You know, the FA Cup, I'm a Liverpool fan, everyone knows that. The FA Cup has a massive significance to us. You know, winning it in 1965 was the moment that we arrived. Everton couldn't say the Mersey Millionaires, they couldn't say we were second class citizens anymore. We'd won everything they'd won then. You know, it's one of them. It means something. The FA Cup means something. And, you know, it was a big gloom and doom. You know, it's a brilliant competition. And for more than a decade, people have talked it down and people have, like, you know, treated it like it's not. And it's just, it's one of the worst scandals of modern football.
And the only reason it's like that is because there's not the same money as the Premier League. Money talks, and that's why everyone talks about the Premier League.
I need you to. These two were being negative before. Now they're being uber positive about the FA Cup. I might suggest it's probably not just about money. It's also about clubs fielding understrength teams in the FA Cup, as they sometimes do, and the fact that there are other options as well, unlike the past. But I like the FA Cup. I don't mind the FA Cup. The one I absolutely hate and refuse to speak about is that other stupid competition that's sponsored by Capital One. But where's your take? What's your take on this?
He hates enough to give the sponsors a boost there. You know, he's mentioned the sponsors. You're everything that's wrong with football. Everything.
Why don't you go have a Budweiser while watching your FA Cup games this weekend?
I like the FA Cup a lot. I mean, it has, you know, there are times when you look at third round games, fourth round games, and perhaps, you know, say it's somebody like a Wigan at home, and it's nothing against Wigan, it's just that they often struggle for attendances, and sometimes a home game for them against a lower division team, you will get a smaller crowd. But you look at somewhere like Mansfield this weekend. Mansfield, who dropped out of the league, whatever it was, five and a half years ago, they're playing Liverpool. They've got, whether they win or not, that is a great day in Mansfield's history. You know, you've got Swansea v Arsenal, Crawley v Reading, West Ham v Man United. Maybe it'll be one of those competitions which sort of peaks in the third round and then it sort of descends into sort of predictability later on. But I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to Swansea Arsenal on Sunday, which I think will be a great game.
So much that you're going to watch the two Premier League sides, yeah?
And then I'm going to Cheltenham versus Everton on Monday. I cannot wait to go to Cheltenham.
Have you been to Cheltenham, Tony?
I refer to it as Nam, and it's you know. Yeah,
it is a hard place. I'm told. Just to wrap this, do we need to? It seems like every year, newspapers are filled like. There's two pieces, right? It's a positive piece, the magic of the FA Cup. Negative piece is what can we do to resurrect the FA Cup. It kind of seems to me like it's sort of doing fine. It's not of overarching importance the way it might have been in the 60s and 70s, but that's fine.
The 80s and 90s?
90s, I don't know. But 90s, yes, sure, whatever. But it doesn't, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, these are compelling matches and, you know.
I'll tell you what, I was sicker at Wembley this year when Chelsea beat us, when that final whistle went. I was sicker then than, you know, oh, we haven't finished fourth. I didn't give a toss about finishing fourth. I was just devastated.
Would you be more devastated if Liverpool got relegated?
If they got relegated, well, it wouldn't be good. I mean, clearly. But I don't, you know.
I'll give you a couple of examples of how important the FA Cup can be. A little while ago, Arsenal were, this was about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, Arsenal were top of the league by 5 points with a game in hand. The very next weekend, they went to Manchester United and fielded an understrength. And Arsene Wenger lied about the players being fit because he had them all on the bench. He said, they're not fit, my senior players aren't fit. They were all on the bench. And Arsenal lost the game 4-0. So they had a great goodwill factor going into the game. And then he put out that team. They lost. They were 3-0 down at halftime. They didn't try a leg. 10,000 supporters were behind the goal at one end, Arsenal supporters. And the crowd turned, and Arsenal hardly won another game for 7 weeks on the back of that result. And if Arsenal fans need a trophy at some point, if they lose to Swansea, Arsene Wenger will be under even more pressure than if he loses to Manchester City in the home game at the Emirates.
I do have a prayer for the FA Cup, which is this. For those ties I will be watching on television when it is a non-league team or a League Two side against a so-called big team, I just hope that it's a close game and not one of those things where, you know, the uber favorite scores twice in the first 15 minutes and then the rest of the game peters out. And when that happens, it stinks. But I guess it makes it all the more special and exciting when the minnow hang in there until the very end, right?
Yeah, well, without a doubt. I mean, you know, one of the things about football, which has made it the game it was over the years, was the build-up in tension and when things unexpected happen. You know, it's, you know, for example, so, you know, in the old days, you know, there weren't that many goals, and when a goal came, it'd be a release of tension. Everyone would be happy. Now you see 10 in a game, and they don't kind of matter anymore. The same way with minnows, you know, it's, if the minnows won every year, FA Cup shucks wouldn't be cup shucks. It'd be FA Cup normal events. So, yeah, so it doesn't happen very often, but that means you got to treasure it when it happens, and let's hope we get one this year, and let's hope it's not Liverpool.
Sorry, you mean let's hope it's not Liverpool, as in, like, let's hope a minnow like Liverpool don't win the FA Cup? All right, what, mid-table now?
Yeah, well, that's all mid-table teams can hope for.
Time now for some quick hits. Luis Suarez scores twice as Liverpool beats Sunderland 3-0. Tony, he's getting a new little buddy up front, Daniel Sturridge. How's that going to work out? Also, did you happen to notice how many of Liverpool's goals yesterday came from short, intricate passing moves?
Well, yeah, exactly. How's it going to work out with Sturridge? Who knows? The manager didn't want him in the summer, so why does he suddenly want him now? I don't see it being a particularly good fit. I think Sturridge thinks he's a better player than he is. I think he's selfish. I think they're talking about shifting Suarez out wide to the left. The proof will be in the pudding, but I don't like it.
Manchester United romp all over Wigan 4-0, and Robin van Persie scores twice. Ollie, that £24 million spent, plus the enormous wages over 4 years, kind of looks like a bargain now. Do you think we'll still be talking about it as a bargain come the end of his contract?
Well, 4 years, as you say. I mean, he's on £200,000 a week, so I think once you've put the transfer and wages in, it'll probably be about £65 million over the course of his contract. That is a hell of a lot of money, considering he's 29 now, he'll be 33 then. But I think if he stays fit, stays injury-free, I think he'll be a really, really good signing for United.
Manchester City play some of their best football of the season as they roll over Stoke 3-0. Stuart, Dzeko's looking pretty good up front. Should he be starting in place of Tevez?
I still think Tevez and Aguero are the best two front players he's got, and they've got a good understanding with each other, and I think they should have stuck with the back three that they played with right at the start of this in pre-season. I thought it worked well with Yaya Toure playing behind those two. They looked unstoppable in that time, but for some reason he didn't go with the back three until about the fourth or fifth game, and then it didn't quite work for him, and it's meant that Tevez and Aguero haven't been able to play up front always by themselves. It's been one of them in a wider, and that doesn't work. So I still think those are the best two, but Dzeko is playing better now.
Joe Cole is on the verge of joining West Ham. Tony, is he a natural fit for Sam Allardyce's progressive brand of football?
Well, is Joe Cole a natural fit for football at the moment? I doubt it. No, it's a strange decision. Although they're only apparently going to be paying £50,000 of his wages, Liverpool will make up the rest with a payoff of £3 million. He struggled for fitness.
Is that coming out of Roy Hodgson's severance, sir?
What Liverpool do best is make payoffs. I don't see it's going to work there. Certainly, I mean, you know, you can argue about Joe Cole all you like. You know, is he the great lost talent of English football, or is he just a waster? I think the truth's somewhere in between, and I don't see this being a successful move by West Ham.
I like the idea of Joe Cole going back home, personally. Everton just won't go away. Ollie, what do the Toffees need, if anything, to be playing Champions League football next season?
Well, if you look at their bench last night, I mean, they don't have the strength and depth that their rivals have. What they do have is a great resilience, a great spirit. They've got some very good players, notably Baines and Fellaini, who I think are outstanding. I still feel that Everton will fall just short.
So to answer my question was, what they need is more players and more depth.
Exactly.
Spurs are now up to third in the table. Stuart, is AVB surpassing your expectations? Say something nice, will you?
Well, I saw AVB's Porto team and I thought they were outstanding. I knew exactly what they were trying to do. Yes, they at times played too high and offside line, which I thought would always be a danger. He wasn't given a fair crack of the whip at Chelsea. And we go back to the Lampard issue and Terry issue. They didn't fancy him at all. I think he's a good coach. I like to see a manager being a coach. He goes out on the training field. He knows exactly what he wants. And I'm surprised that he's done so well, because I didn't think Tottenham fans would take to him because he had a failure at Chelsea. But I'm really pleased for him, and I hope Tottenham go on and get that third spot.
There you go. That's the one thing. He basically lives on the training pitch.
Gab, here's one for you. The transfer window just opened. Is there going to be a massive deal, or are you going to say the biggest deal's already been done?
It's already happened. It's Lucas Moura to Paris Saint-Germain, and I'm kind of shocked how, I guess because we knew that this was going to happen in the summer, people sort of all forgot about it. Now, whether it'll work for PSG, I don't know. Obviously, Ancelotti's got, it hasn't worked perfectly for him. He's got too many good players, and he's struggling to get them to fit and whatever, but I think this guy is the real deal, I think it'd have a huge impact in terms of the Champions League as well. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun, and it's been real, and it's been real fun. Thanks to my guests, Tony Evans, Ollie Kay, and Stuart Robson. You can come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts, or as so many of you do every week, please email us at gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. That mailbox does get full very quickly, Skinner, so let's make sure we clear it every 48 hours or so. You can go to thetimes.co.uk for all your news, views, web chats, blogs, analysis. Tony and I are on Twitter, as is Ollie. Stuart hasn't got the Twitter bug yet, which is probably why he's wiser and has more hair than the rest of us. Till next time, bye-bye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.